A month ago, I was at a farewell breakfast for Leota Esther, and I sat next to Ellen Court, the first Wisconsin poet laureate. And I love Ellen. I also know that conversations with Ellen are rather intense. You're not going to be talking about the weather and whether the scrambled eggs are really good today. So she turned to me after a few minutes and said something like, "Do you have anything really big left in your life that you want to do?" My first thought was, I'm only 50. I have a lot left. And then I couldn't think of anything. I guess that wasn't a question I was prepared to answer. And so maybe I thought I need to give that question some thought. Do I really have anything big left in my life that I want to do? Our worship and learning theme this month is, what does it mean to live a life of yearning? And yearning, I think, is actually a really great framework for thinking about this question. So another way to put Ellen's question is, what is it that I yearn for as I look ahead to the rest of my life? And there are so many things you can yearn for in life. Here are some that come to mind for me. Good health for myself and my loved ones. Loving and vibrant family relationships. A nurturing network of close friends, acceptance and affirmation, travels, nice things, financial security in old age, work that feels rewarding and meaningful, spiritual wholeness, maybe the Detroit Tigers winning the World Series again. And stepping back from this list, I have to admit that this is a list generated by someone who lives a life of privilege. Many people in this world, including in the Fox Valley, including in this fellowship, might list things like enough food to eat, access to basic health and dental care, a place to live, less anxiety about staying above water financially, a secure job, a cessation of violence within the house. It's important for me to acknowledge that I lead a life of privilege, and so I do so with mindfulness. One of my questions for today, for you, is what among the things you yearn for abides? And by abides, I mean what among the things that you yearn for really matters in the long run? If you are lucky enough to live a long and good life, what among the things that you've done and experienced and acquired will actually feel like it matters when you get to the end of the line? What stands the test of time? And you know what? There's a whole lot that doesn't really matter in the long run. If you have enough money and things to live without fear of hunger or homelessness, at some point, I think, you realize that there's some relative emptiness in acquiring more things. My colleague Leah notes that yearning can be poisonous. Yearning for things is what compels us so often to jump onto that consumerist, capitalist treadmill. We work harder and longer and more frantically so that we can acquire more things. Sooner or later, we realize that these things don't really matter. But the hours lost with parents, with children, with spouse, with friends, the hours lost in pursuit of the things, well, you know what? That really does matter a lot. Some yearning is life-draining. Other yearning is life-giving. God, grant me the serenity not to yearn for the things that drain my life, the courage to yearn for that which is life-giving, and the wisdom to know the difference. Well, today I want to suggest that doing our little part to help build a better world is something that matters. Desiring a better, fairer, more peaceful, more environmentally healthy world, well, that is yearning that abides. If at the end of our lives we can look back and know that we did our little part to advance the well-being of the world, I think we will look back and say, you know what? Our time and our energy was well spent. So I believe that yearning and working for a better world are important focuses for the spiritual life. When I think about the great trailblazers of social justice, it is easy to see that yearning for a better world is part of what motivated and inspired them to do their work. Susan B. Anthony wanted a world where women have full human rights. Frederick Douglass wanted a world where no one is enslaved or treated as less than human. Mahatma Gandhi yearned for a world in which people could rule their own country with justice and not be ruled by racist imperialists. He yearned for a world in which Hindus and Muslims and Christians could live side by side in peace and harmony. Nelson Mandela yearns for a world in which official and unofficial apartheid no longer exists. Harvey Milk yearned for a world in which lesbian and gay and bisexual and transgender folks no longer have to fear being persecuted, attacked, or bullied. Aung San Suu Kyi yearns for a world in which despotic military rulers no longer run over their people. Part of the extraordinary courage and the amazing tenacity of these people, I think, comes from the depth of their yearning for a better world. That yearning fueled their resolve. It kept them going, even when the odds seemed so long. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech is all about yearning. I have a dream, he said, that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even in the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, that it will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day, right there in Alabama, little black boys and little black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places shall be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. You see, that speech painted a picture of the world that Dr. King wanted to see. It's the world he was yearning for. 45 years after he was killed trying to make that dream come true, the dream still speaks. It has the power to get folks, maybe even you and me, off our beds and sofas and desk chairs to fight racism within our communities and within ourselves. I shared with you before about Parker Palmer and what his reply is when he hears someone make a racist or sexist or homophobic remark. He says something like, "That personally hurts me because I so deeply want to live in a world in which everyone is treated fairly and valued and respected for who they are." That reply is about yearning. That's where the power of that comes from. Wanting to be in a world where everybody's treated fairly and respected and valued. Now, Parker Palmer knows, and certainly Martin Luther King Jr. knew, that this promised land we seek is not something we're going to arrive at soon or easily. In his last speech before his death, Dr. King concluded his speech with these words: "Like anybody, I'd like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there, But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. I don't think any of us are going to get to the promised land in our lifetimes. Nelson Mandela saw the end of apartheid. But even today, more than 20 years later, he knows that his nation has not yet reached the promised land. Inequality, poverty, racism still mar and ruin too many lives, especially black lives, in South Africa. None of us gets to the promised land. If you want to get there in your lifetime, then you're going to find the work of social justice to be incredibly frustrating and heartbreaking and unfulfilling. Progress is usually so slow that it is imperceptible. Justice is work that requires an understanding that you're in it for the long haul. To stay in the struggle, you need to cultivate patience about seeing the results for which you yearn so deeply. And I'm not suggesting you need to be patient with injustice itself. Dr. King rightly challenged white liberals who counseled him to slow down and not get too far ahead of white people's willingness to change. He rejected that. "We must be impatient with injustice," he said in his famous letter from Birmingham jail. But at the same time, we need to know in our hearts that these things don't happen overnight, or even in our lifetime necessarily. And I think this is especially tough today, in this era of instant gratification and short attention spans. Justice work takes a lot of attention, it takes a lot of focus, it takes perseverance, tenacity, pacing. Otherwise, we just give up because we're not getting anywhere, it feels like. We give up and we walk away from what we ought to be doing. Lately, I've been thinking a lot about some of the early pioneers of the LGBT human rights movement who labored in such obscurity and danger in the 1940s, and 50s, and 60s, and earlier, before Stonewall. It's really easy to trace the start of the gay rights movement to that riot at Greenwich Village's Stonewall Inn in 1969, a spontaneous eruption demonstration against yet another brutal police raid on a gay establishment. But the gay rights movement did not start out of nothing at Stonewall. Countless brave but not widely noted acts by LGBT folks prior to Stonewall prepared the ground for then this full-throttled gay rights movement. Just like countless acts before Rosa Parks decided to sit on her seat in that bus paved the way for the eruption of the civil rights movement. So, how can we do the work of building the world we yearn for over the long haul? Here's some ways, I think. We need to keep on dreaming about the world that could one day come to be and banish acceptance, passive acceptance of the status quo of injustice. Even as we're impatient with injustice, we need to understand that real change takes generations. We need to banish the kind of impatience that causes us to quit. We need to practice humility and banish grandiosity. None of us, not even a Dr. King or a Susan B. Anthony, can accomplish change on our own. We need other people joining with us in this work. Grandiosity doesn't work. And what's more, it makes us take on the guilt of failing when we don't get the immediate results we seek, and then, again, we quit. We need to cultivate hope and faith in a better future and banish despair and pessimism. Hope and despair, Joan Chittister writes, are cut from the same cloth. But she goes on to say that despair is a spiritual disease and hope its antidote. Dr. King was honest about the rampant injustice of his time, but he did fervently believe that one day, no doubt after he was long gone, his people would get to the promised land. That hope kept him and kept the movement going, and it changed the world. We need to find sources of renewal and banish the practices that cause us to burn out in justice work. Too many Unitarian Universalists over the years have created a dualism between spiritual deepening on the one hand and doing justice. Like it's either one or the other. The fact is, you have to have both. If you don't have the spiritual life, you're not going to be able to do the justice work for the long haul. They go hand in hand. And we need to focus our efforts and banish a scattershot approach to social justice. There are so many good and worthy and compelling causes out there, but no one of us can take them all on, or even a lot of them. So find a cause or two that speaks to you, and trust that others passionate about other issues will take on those other worthy issues that you're ignoring. Don't dilute your focus. I'm excited about our connecting conversations going on right now, one-on-one conversations that more than anything else help folks who are sharing figure out what it is they're most passionate about. So cultivate dreaming and banish passive acceptance of the status quo. Cultivate impatience for injustice and patience for the results you seek. Cultivate humility and banish grandiosity. Cultivate hope and faith and banish despair and pessimism. Cultivate renewal and banish burnout. Cultivate focus and banish taking on so many causes that you don't do any good in any of them. This is the way to sustain the work of planting the seeds of social justice. Too many of us, like the woman in the parable that Margaret read, say forget it and walk out of the seed store because it's too hard. We want solutions now, not a bunch of seeds we have to nurture. And then too many of us, honestly, take too many seed packets and we drive ourselves into the ground trying to plant them and grow them until we finally throw up our hands in defeat. So our world needs each one of us to take one or two seed packets and make growing them one of the focal points of our lives. This is how the world gets changed. This is how together we'll build a land where we bind up the broken. This is how we'll build a land where the captives go free, where the oil of gladness dissolves all mourning. This is how we'll build a promised land that can be a land where justice rolls down like waters and peace like an ever-flowing stream. May it be so.